Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour and the Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week, on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on personal identification. All right, last time we were talking about personal identification in the context of Heibel, spelled H-I-I-B-E-L, versus the 6th Judicial District Court of Nevada, Humboldt County, et al. The case number 03-5554. That's 03-5554. You'll find that at Find Law. Get a copy. It's 13 pages. Has both the majority and minority reports. The majority opinion and the minority dissenting opinions. There's two dissenting opinions. Justice Stevens, dissenting, wrote a separate opinion. And then the other three justices, see if I got their names here for you for the record, Justice Breyer, Souter, and Ginsburg joined in their dissenting view of this case called Heibel. Now, Heibel deals with personal identification. If you'd like to have the whole series of programs, just go to my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Look on the archives, and you can get the whole series of programs in our analysis of the new Heibel rule. Now, I showed you last time that when you get your news, when you get your law from the Boston Herald or the New York Times, you're going to get yellow journalism. You know, people who are lay people themselves, journalists, who are going to write about law, really don't know what it is that they're reporting on. So a good source would be Lawyers Alert or some other news publication published for lawyers. A lawyer writing this would do a little better job of writing. I've received so many calls from my students asking me about this very subject of personal identification pursuant to Brown v. Texas and Lawson v. Colander. Over the years, I've taught thousands of students, and those students, of course, are all familiar with Brown and Lawson, Fourth and Fifth Amendment protections and how they interplay. Occasionally, the court will actually reverse itself. The number of times that the court has reversed itself are you know, you can count them on about two hands max, maybe even on one hand. Now, distinguishing cases is fairly common. It's not very, very common, but it's fairly common to take a doctrine, a case, and distinguish that case from the other cases, which are, in fact, the run-of-the-mill rule of thumb that we follow. So Brown versus Texas is the rule of thumb that we're going to follow on the Fourth Amendment. Lawson versus Colander, ditto. We're going to follow that as a rule of thumb. Terry versus Ohio, we're going to follow that rule. Miranda versus Arizona, we're going to follow that rule. Delaware versus Prowse, we're going to follow that rule. None of those cases have been overturned or changed one iota. But in the Heibel case, as it relates to personal identification, which comes up fairly often in 20 cases, 20 states have a personal identification rule. And what that requires is that you identify yourself to a police officer upon demand. Now, this identification has been held to be unconstitutional because of Brown and Lawson for at least 25 years that I know of. The rule of thumb that we've all been following is that it's none of your business but out. And that's the minority view here in this 5-4 split decision at the U.S. Supreme Court. Has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with the construction of the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, our federal constitution, and you can see that as you read through. The logic, the reasoning of the five majority justices is well thought out. I can't find any argument with it. If I were going to be a justice in this case, I would have voted with the minority. My view is that the Fourth and Fifth Amendments ought to be absolute, not qualified, and that the name, as well as any other statement that you want from me, should be absolutely prohibited. And that's the rule that we've been following for many years. But that rule was never cast in concrete, as the majority points out in this case, Heibel. And because of that, they're going to cast it in concrete, which they just did. And so now we have a burden. The burden of going forward now shifts to the defendant at the scene of the crime to establish a reasonable basis, not one that's out in la-la land now, but a reasonable basis as to why it is that you fear giving your name could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation, which contains, among other things, a testimony against yourself that you don't want to give, which is protected by the Fifth Amendment. Now, the court, conversely, the majority view says, yeah, but giving your name is not incriminating. In 99.9% of all of the contacts that you're going to have with any and everybody, including the police. And I agree with them. I think that's probably true. The reason that I like absolutes in law, I like laws that say thou shalt not steal, because now I know what my burden, what my duty is. I know what property rights are. It tells me, it gives me an absolute. There's no gray area. In this case here, there's a gray area. The court just created it. There used to be a black and white, that when the police talk to you, you don't have to talk back. You have a right to remain silent. That's what Miranda tells us. But now the distinguishing characteristic is, in Miranda, when you're under arrest, you don't have to talk. But in a Terry stop, here we go with the Terry stop and frisk rule. Assuming that the Terry stop and frisk rule is reasonable law, and it's been on the books for 38 years or 36 years, so I guess it's reasonable. Whether it is or not, it's the law of the land. We've always in the past said, well, we don't have to talk. So listen to the minority view as they view this same issue. Judges that oftentimes vote for the majority, vote with these other five judges. When a case comes down, 9-0, all 9 of them are voting the same way. But in this case, it's split narrowly 5-4, and Justice Stevens said, the Nevada law at issue in this case imposes a narrow duty to speak upon a specific class of individuals. The class includes only those persons detained by a police officer under circumstances which reasonably indicate that the person has committed, is in the process of committing, or is about to commit a crime. Persons who are, in other words, targets of a criminal investigation. The statute, therefore, is directed not at the public at large, but rather at a highly selective group inherently suspect of criminal activities. Now, under the Nevada law, a member of the targeted class may not be compelled to answer. They may not be compelled to answer any inquiry except a command that he identify himself. Refusal to identify yourself upon request is punishable as a crime. Presumably, the statute does not require the detainee to answer any other question because the Nevada legislature realized that the Fifth Amendment prohibits compelling the target of a criminal investigation to make any other statement. In my judgment, the broad constitutional right to remain silent, which derives from the Fifth Amendment's guarantee that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, from the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment is not as circumscribed as the court suggests and does not admit even of the narrow exception defined by the Nevada statute. Now, I happen to side with Justice Stevens. I hold that view. Now, oftentimes people will say, well, there comes the court again, splitting 5-4. Here comes another one of those political lawmaking rulings. No, I disagree with that. This is a judicial view of the construction of the Fifth Amendment. George Gordon sides with Justice Stevens. I believe Justice Stevens is correct. I prefer that view of the Fifth Amendment. However, the majority has a well-reasoned and logical conclusion to the construction of the Fifth Amendment as it relates to this Nevada statute. The Nevada legislature, remember that the legislature, a political body elected by you people in Nevada, is God. And they make law. That's what a sovereign is. A sovereign is a lawmaker. God is a lawmaker. Nevada is a sovereign. Nevada is a god. The god of Nevada, the legislature, has enacted a law. I think that that contradicts and contravenes our Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. I think it's a direct violation of "you shall have no other gods before me." But you know, boys and girls, I don't make these rules and laws and legislatures, and I just got on the scene here in 1939, so I have to play the game the way somebody else writes the rules. And in this case, this is the way the rules are written. Now, when the policeman stops me and asks me for my name, I have 12 questions that I want to ask the policeman. I don't know if these are the same 12 questions you should ask or not. If you'd like to see these 12 questions, just send me a $5 bill, $5 Fed note, in an envelope with your name and address, and I'll send you the 12 questions that I think should be asked at the scene to determine whether or not the Fourth and Fifth Amendment or one or the other of these amendments apply in your case at the scene. Along with what are the police's, or what is the policeman's duty to protect you, the citizen? The answer is none at all. And I have a 2-page article here that I'll include with that. So that you can carry it in the glove compartment of your car, so that you can carry it with you in your wallet, or wherever you want. And in case this ever comes up, you can assert your Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, because nothing in the law has been changed. Just the burden now. You have to now know how to assert your Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights as it applies to your personal identification, whereas in the past, all you had to do was shut up. Now, you can't just shut up. Now you have to know why you're shutting up, and you have to articulate it at the scene. Now, there can be no doubt that the Fifth Amendment, or the privilege, is available outside of criminal court proceedings and serves to protect persons in all settings in which their freedom of action is curtailed in any significant way from being compelled to incriminate themselves. We see that in Miranda versus Arizona. Remember, that's cited at 384 U.S. 436. Now, it's a settled principle that the police have the right to request citizens to answer voluntarily questions concerning unsolved crimes. But the police have no right to compel them to answer. All right, now take a look at that. The police have a right to ask you, but they have no right to compel you to answer. Now, that's cited from Davis versus Mississippi. I made reference to that a little earlier. That's cited at 394 U.S. 721. Davis versus Mississippi, 394 U.S. 721. By the way, you can get a copy of this case off of the internet, and you'll find it at FindLaw. Just go to FindLaw. If you can't find FindLaw, then go to Yahoo or Google and ask where to find FindLaw, and then go to Hybel versus 6th Judicial District Court. That name is spelled H-I-I-B-E-L. And the number that you're looking for is 03-5554. That's 03-5554. 13 pages. Pull the case up. Read it for yourself. We're on page 9 of that report. Now, the protections of the Fifth Amendment are directly and directed squarely toward those who are the focus of the government's investigative and prosecutorial powers. In a criminal trial, the indicted defendant has an unqualified right to refuse to testify and may not be punished for invoking that right. The unindicted target of a grand jury investigation enjoys the same constitutional protection, even if he has been served with a subpoena. So does an arrested suspect during custodial interrogation in a police station. See Miranda. All right, now let's distinguish this. Now, if the policeman says you're under arrest, you don't have to give him your name. That's protected under Miranda. What we're talking about here is this guy, Heibel, has not been arrested yet. The policeman walks up to him. Heibel is leaning up against his pickup. There's an unidentified female inside, and Heibel is an unidentified male on the outside. The policeman wants to identify these people. He has a right and a duty to ask this guy, what's his name? The question that we're trying to answer here in our analysis is, does Heibel have a corresponding duty to tell the officer what his name is? Under the Nevada statute, the answer is yes. And remember, in this case, as distinguished from Brown and Lawson, this guy, in this case, is the target of an investigation because the policeman has been called out to investigate. Hang on, let's take a little break here, and let me remind you that in real estate transactions, we follow three rules. It's called location, location, location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when talking to the police or government agents, and that is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Knowing what to say, and when to say it, and what not to say, and who not to say it to, is summed up in this maxim of law. And that is, all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these. Listen to this first judge. He said, quote, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" That's cited from U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, you know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester, wouldn't I? Hey, listen to the second judge. He said, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." That's Belknap versus United States. You know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. Now, listen to this third judge. Here's what he had to say. Quote, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the far-sighted." Cited from Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, informative, it's free. Remember, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. You ought to do that right now before you forget. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, the dissenting opinion, this is Justice Stevens. He goes on to tell us that some internal quotation marks have been omitted here, and he's citing the printed text that I'm reading from. Typically, this means that the officer may ask the detainee a moderate number of questions to determine his identity and try to obtain information confirming or dispelling the officer's suspicions. But the detainee is not obliged to respond. See Terry versus Ohio, 392 U.S. at page 34. And it says, of course, one person stopped is not obliged to answer. Answers may not be compelled, and refusal to answer furnishes no basis for arrest, although it may alert the officer to the need for continued observation. Given our statements to the effect that citizens are not required to respond to police officers' questions during a Terry stop, It is no surprise that the petitioner assumed, as we have, that he had a right not to disclose his identity. Now, the court correctly observes that a communication does not enjoy the Fifth Amendment privilege unless it is testimonial. Although the court declines to resolve this question, I think it clear that this case concerns a testimonial communication, recognizing that whether a communication is testimonial is sometimes a difficult question. Now, we have stated generally that it is the extortion of information from the accused, the attempt to force him to disclose the contents of his own mind, that implicates the self-incrimination clause. Now, I might want to pause here and point this out. Let me make a comment. Notice here that it is compelled testimony that violates the Fifth Amendment, not voluntary testimony. So after the policeman has warned you that you have a right to remain silent and anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, if you want to open up and talk to the policeman and give him information, that's your business. You certainly have a right to do that. But the courts back in the Warren Burger era, back in the 70s, required that the police at least inform you that you've got a right to remain silent. Up to that time, the police did not have to remind you or inform you that you had a right to remain silent. The presumption was that, hey, listen, folks, you're the people who are the sovereigns. You're the people that wrote the Constitution. The policeman is the servant, and the citizen is the master. Surely you must know what you wrote into your own Constitution. You don't need your servant to tell you what you already know, master. Now, unfortunately, over a period of years, with the immigrants that have come into the United States, I can tell you right now, the average Mexican coming into the United States, you know, those 2,000 a day coming across the border, or those that have come in the last 25 or 50 years, they haven't got a clue as to what their rights are. So in Miranda, the court said, well, we need to tell those people because they don't know. We're going to presume they don't know. Now, here's a guy, Heibel. We presume he did know his rights, and he said, I'm not going to talk. I'm not going to give you my name. I don't know what Heibel's suspicions were or what his fears were. He may have thought, gee, I might have a warrant out for my arrest. But he didn't articulate it to the officer. And so the majority view here is that since he didn't, and since Nevada is one of those 20 states that has this statute that requires this identification, then the burden shifted to Heibel. He had to tell his servant, well, I'm glad you're out here doing your job, officer, and I'm glad you're investigating this potential crime, and I'm happy to be paying my taxes to pay your salary. However, I don't want to answer the question because I'm afraid that it could be the beginning point of a separate criminal investigation involving me. Had I been there, I probably would have done the same thing Heibel did. It's none of your business, butt out. That's the minority view now. Now, since that's the case, and we can't say it's none of your business, butt out, we have to be able to ask articulate questions of the police officer to come to the conclusion that his investigation is testimonial in nature and it's compelled. So we have to be able to show what's compelled. So I sat down and I jotted down 12 questions that I would ask the officer. And if you'd like to have these 12 questions printed out to carry in your glove compartment of your car or in your wallet, why don't you just drop a $5 bill in the mail, send it to me, and I'll send that to you. I'm not going to tell you what to do. That's legal advice. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not here to give you legal advice. Here's what I think I'm going to do in the event that the event ever occurs to me. Now, I've had this come up a number of times in the past. As a civil rights investigator, I've been arrested and jailed a number of times. I've always remained silent. I wouldn't tell them my name, address, or anything about me. And I've never had a problem. But in the future, my state, Missouri, requires the same identification. Now, our statute is not directly to the point, but you can rest assured that now that this case has been decided, the other 19 states are all going to amend their personal identification statute to follow the specificity that you see here in the Nevada statute, so that they will all stand constitutional muster. Now, here's another factor. You see, they didn't need to meet constitutional muster because 99.9% of all the people that the policeman asks or demands that they tell him his name are going to tell him. They're not going to know that they have a right to remain silent. They don't care about it anyway. And they're going to produce their driver's license because everybody's pretty proud of the fact that they've got a driver's license. But what do you do if you don't have a driver's license? What if you don't have a Social Security number? What if you don't carry any state identification at all? None, zero, zilch, zip. Now, there's no law that requires me to carry an identification, and I don't. And there's no law that requires me that I identify myself to the policeman. So long as the policeman gives me reason to believe that he's on a compelled testimonial objective trying to get me to testify to give information that he can use against me. Now, while the vast majority, now this is the dissenting opinion of Justice Stevens, he says, while the vast majority of verbal statements thus will be testimonial, and to that extent at least will fall within the privilege, then certain acts of physical evidence fall outside the privilege. In all instances, we have afforded Fifth Amendment protection if the disclosure in question was being admitted because of its content rather than some other aspect of the communication. Now, considered in light of these precedents, the compelled statement at issue in this case is clearly testimonial. It is significant that the communication must be made in response to a question posed by a police officer. And as we recently explained, albeit in a different context of the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause, whatever else the term testimonial covers, it applies at a minimum to police interrogations. Surely police questioning during a Terry stop qualifies as an interrogation, and it follows that responses to such questions are testimonial in nature, including the identification of the subject. Now, rather than determining whether the communication at issue is testimonial, the court instead concludes that the state can compel the disclosure of one's identity because it is not incriminating. But our cases have afforded Fifth Amendment protection to statements that are incriminating in a much broader sense than the court suggests, and it has long been settled that the Fifth Amendment's protection encompasses compelled statements that lead to the discovery of incriminating evidence. Even though the statements themselves are not incriminating of and by themselves and are not introduced into evidence. By incriminating, we have meant disclosures that could be used in a criminal prosecution or could lead to other evidence that might be used. Communications, in other words, that would furnish a link in the chain of evidence needed to prosecute the claimant for a federal crime. Thus, compelled testimony that communicates information that may lead to incriminating evidence is privileged even if the information itself is not inculpatory. Now, given a proper understanding of the category of incriminating, communications that fall within the Fifth Amendment privilege, it's clear that the disclosure of the petitioner's identity is protected. And the court reasons that we should not assume that the disclosure of the petitioner's name would be used to incriminate him or that it would furnish a link in a chain of evidence needed to prosecute him. But why else would an officer ask for it? And why else would the Nevada legislature require its disclosure only when circumstances reasonably indicate that the person has committed, is committing, or is about to commit a crime? So if the court is correct, then the petitioner's refusal to cooperate did not impede the police investigation at all. Indeed, if we accept the predicate for the court's holding, the statute requires nothing more than a useless invasion of privacy. And I think that, on the contrary, the Nevada legislature intended to provide its police officers with a useful law enforcement tool, and that the very existence of the statute demonstrates the value of the information that it demands. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself must be incompetent, just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen, he's a professor at the Hastings Law School, when he said, quote, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. Hey, it's worse than that, he said. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to her on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. So whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax. Unquote. That was Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. So if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're reading the minority view, Justice Stevens, isn't it? Let me see if I got that right. Justice Stevens filed a separate dissenting opinion, and then it was followed by the other three justices, Breyer, Souter, and Ginsburg, also joined in the dissent. Now, to give you an illustration as to where you're at with conservative versus liberal judges, the liberal judges, with whom I'm agreeing in this case, are ruling in favor of the criminals, ruling in favor of the citizenry, ruling in favor of the guy on the street rather than the police. The conservatives, this is the Republicans, the majority in this case, are voting for and with the police. So you'll find that in political affairs, I'm opposed to the liberal political agenda, but I'm in favor of the liberal judicial agenda. I'm really happy when we have liberal judges who are appointed to the courts. And I'm just as tickled when those same liberals are defeated for political office. You see, the liberals are the big government and the big spenders, until George Bush, the closet conservative, or the closet liberal, I guess I should say in this case, came to power. Now we find that this guy can spend money faster than all of the Democrats combined, including Ronald Reagan. Remember, Reagan used to be a liberal Democrat, and he converted and changed parties. That way he could run as a conservative Republican and bring in his liberal agenda, the liberal political agenda, into public life, and everybody bought into it. Now, I don't care too much for Ginsburg and these other liberals over here who want to construe our Second Amendment as if the Second Amendment was written as an afterthought and doesn't apply to real people, only to militias, only to the army. So There are times when we agree and there's times when we dissent. But as a general rule, you can just about bet that the liberal judges are going to be voting for citizens and citizens' rights. Because their mindset of construction of the law is the opposite from the conservative. The conservative is sitting over here saying, we need to give the police more powers to protect us from terrorists. That was mentioned in this case. That's poppycock. They use the word terrorist and terror as a buzzword so that they can excuse their constitutional deprivations and enforce upon us this Patriot Act and Homeland Security crap. Now, if that were actually brought up before the Supreme Court, we don't know how they're going to rule on it, depending upon the circumstances that are involved. Just like we see here in this case. I would have bet that the court was going to rule, as they always have, pursuant to Brown and Lawson. They didn't. They didn't overturn Brown or Lawson, but they distinguished this Heibel case. So now all of us, well, we're just a minority. I mean, you know, we're just the average Joe Sixpack on the street. We now have to know what to ask the policeman to create the environment, to create the factual challenge to refuse to answer. Everybody else in the country is just going to answer the question. So for practical purposes, by shifting the burden onto the public has lost their right to remain silent concerning their names. But that's because of their own ignorance. That's not because of the court's ruling. So a person's identity obviously bears information and incriminating value, even if the name itself is not inculpatory. A name can provide the key to a broad array of information about the person, particularly in the hands of a police officer with access to a range of law enforcement databases. And that information, in turn, can be tremendously useful in a criminal prosecution. It's therefore very wrong to suggest that a person's identity provokes or provides a link in the chain to incriminating evidence only in unusual circumstances. The officer in this case told the petitioner, in the court's words, that he was conducting an investigation and needed to see some identification. As the target of that investigation, the petitioner, in my view, acted well within his rights when he opted to stand mute. Accordingly, I respectfully dissent. So you'll notice here that, in my view, he acted well within his rights when he opted to stand mute. From now on, instead of standing mute, we need to ask some questions of the police officer. All right, now let's take a look at the three other justices. They wrote a separate opinion. Justice Breyer, Souter, and Ginsburg join in the dissent. They join in this dissenting opinion. Notwithstanding the vagrancy statutes to which the majority refers, this court's Fourth Amendment precedents make clear that police may conduct a Terry stop only within circumscribed limits, and one of those limits invalidates laws that compel responses to police questioning. In Terry v. Ohio, the court considered whether police, in the absence of probable cause, can stop, question, or frisk an individual at all. The court recognized that the Fourth Amendment protects the right of every individual to the possession and control of his own person. At the same time, it recognized that in certain circumstances, public safety might require a limited seizure or stop of an individual against his will. The court consequently set forth conditions circumscribing when and how the police might conduct a Terry stop. They include what has become known as the reasonable suspicion standard. Justice White, in a separate concurring opinion, set forth further conditions. Justice White wrote, "Of course, the person stopped is not obliged to answer. Answers may not be compelled, and refusal to answer furnishes no basis for an arrest, although it may alert the officer to the need for continued observation." Now, about 10 years later in the court, in Brown versus Texas held that police lacked any reasonable suspicion to detain the particular petitioner and require him to identify himself. The court noted that the trial judge had asked the following: "I'm sure officers conducting a Terry stop should ask everything they possibly could find out. What I'm asking is, what's the state's interest in putting a man in jail because he doesn't want to answer?" Now, the court referred to Justice White's Terry concurrence, and it said that it need not decide the matter. Then 5 years later, the court wrote that an officer may ask the Terry detainee a moderate number of questions to determine his identity and to try to obtain information confirming or dispelling the officer's suspicions. But the detainee is not obliged to respond. That came from Berkemer versus McCarty. And they went on to say that the suspect must be free to decline to answer the questions put to him, stating that allowing officers to stop and question a fleeing person is quite consistent with the individual's right to go about his business or to stay put and remain silent in the face of police questioning. This lengthy history of concurring opinions, of references, and of clear, explicit statements means that the court's statement in Berkemer, while technically dicta, is the kind of strong dicta that the legal community typically takes as a statement of law, and the law has remained undisturbed for more than 20 years. Now, there's no good reason now to reject this generation-old statement of the law. There are sound reasons rooted in Fifth Amendment considerations for adhering to this Fourth Amendment legal condition, circumscribing police authority to stop an individual against his will. Now, administrative considerations also militate against change. Can a state, in addition to requiring a stopped individual to answer "what's your name," also require an answer to "what's your license plate number" or "where do you live"? Can a police officer, who must know how to make a Terry stop, keep track of the constitutional answers? After all, answers to any of these questions may or may not incriminate depending upon the circumstances. Indeed, as the majority points out, a name itself, even if it is not Killer Bill or Rough 'Em Up Harry, will sometimes provide the police with a link in the chain of evidence needed to convict the individual of a separate offense. The majority reserves judgment about whether compulsion is permissible in such instances. How then is a police officer in the midst of a Terry stop to distinguish between the majority's ordinary case and this special case where the majority reserves judgment? The majority presents no evidence that the rule enunciated by Justice White and then by Berkemer Court, which for nearly a generation has set forth a settled Terry stop condition, has significantly interfered with law enforcement, nor has the majority presented any other convincing justification for change. I would not begin to erode a clear rule with special exceptions, so I consequently dissent. Now, this is a split decision, 5-4, on the technical aspects of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. Now hang on, we'll take a break right here and we'll be back with further analysis when we look at Brown v. Texas right after this break. Now you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm. But you know, submissiveness is not our heritage. Our First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as the heritage of Americans. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression, of the press, political, and social activities free from government surveillance. Now that quotation comes from Justice William O. Douglas of the Supreme Court. You know, our princes and politicians beller in the halls of Congress. They want more taxes, they want more spending, and more gun control. But you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from our political process, doesn't come from our politicians, doesn't come from our lawyers, and it surely doesn't come from our bureaucrats. Now, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and then I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, you give George Gordon the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not politics. So if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, let's take a look at Brown v. Texas, decided back in 1979. Brown v. Texas has been the basis of what most of us have presumed to be our Fourth and Fifth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizure in light of both Terry and Miranda. All you have to do is sit back and shut up. Don't even tell them your name. Now, Heibel is a case that's being distinguished from Brown. So Brown is a short case, just two or three pages. So let me run over the Brown decision with you. Brown v. Texas is cited at 443 U.S. 47. Two police officers, while cruising near noon in a patrol car, observed the appellant and another man walking away from one another in an alley. And it was in an area with a high incidence of drug traffic. So they stopped and they asked the appellant, Brown, to identify himself and explain what he was doing there. One officer testified that he stopped the appellant because the situation looked suspicious, and we'd never seen that subject in that area before. Now, the officers did not claim to suspect the appellant of any specific misconduct, nor did they have any reason to believe that he was armed. Now, when the appellant refused to identify himself, he was arrested for violation of a Texas statute which makes it a criminal act for a person to refuse to give his name and address to an officer who has lawfully stopped him and requested the information. Now, the appellant's motion to set aside an information charging him with violation of the statute on the grounds that the statute violated the First, Fourth, Fifth, and Fourteenth Amendments was denied, and he was convicted and fined. So, it was held. The application of the Texas statute to detain the appellant and require him to identify himself violated the Fourth Amendment because the officers lacked any reasonable suspicion to believe that the appellant was engaged or had engaged in criminal conduct. Detaining the appellant to require him to identify himself constituted a seizure of his person subject to the requirement of the Fourth Amendment that the seizure be reasonable. All right, let's stop and analyze this. Notice now that in the Heibel case, the distinguishing characteristic between Brown and Heibel is that in Brown, the policeman stopped him without articulable, reasonable suspicion. In the Heibel case, the officer had been called out to the scene to investigate. He had articulable, reasonable suspicion. Detaining the appellant then to require him to identify himself constituted a seizure of his person subject to the requirement of the Fourth Amendment that the seizure be reasonable. In Heibel, the seizure was reasonable. In Brown, the seizure was not reasonable. In Heibel, the statute was upheld. In Texas, the statute was not overturned. Can you see the distinction? The court upheld the Nevada statute, but they did not overturn the Texas statute. In California, they overturned the California statute and called it constitutionally vague and ambiguous. Very important distinctions here. And that's the way the court has distinguished Heibel from Brown. Now, the Fourth Amendment requires that such a seizure be based on specific objective facts indicating that society's legitimate interests require such action, or that the seizure be carried out pursuant to a plan embodying explicit neutral limitations on the conduct of individual police officers. Delaware v. Prowse, cited at 440 U.S. 648, here, the state does not contend that the appellant was stopped pursuant to a practice embodying neutral criteria, and the officer's actions were not justified on the ground that they had a reasonable suspicion, based upon any articulable objective facts, that he was involved in criminal activity. So, absent any basis for suspecting the appellant of any misconduct, the balance between the public interest in crime prevention and the appellant's right to personal security and privacy tilts in favor of freedom from police interference. All right, so in Delaware versus Prowse, it was a random stop and search. A classic case of a fishing expedition. This is not a fishing expedition on the part of the policeman in the Heibel case in Nevada. Remember, the policeman was called out there to investigate. He had probable cause to believe that a crime was either in the process of being committed or had already been committed, and he was there to investigate. If nothing else, Heibel was a witness who might have seen the guy who assaulted the woman in the pickup, and his refusal to identify himself was, in fact, obstructing and delaying an officer in the performance of his duty. He was acting as a third party who had information between a conflict between the officer and whoever it was that he was looking for who was getting away. Now, the woman sitting in the pickup is also a witness, isn't she? And even if the woman in the pickup doesn't want to testify against Heibel or speak out against him, since somebody called the police, and since in the Heibel case we now have a distinguishing characteristic, if these two people didn't want to identify themselves to the police officer, then it's up to them to show that the reason they don't want to identify themselves is because they have a real suspicion or fear that the information of giving you my name could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation used against me. Which, you know, just first thing that jumps to your mind is that there is a warrant out there that may be on the NCIC computer or somebody else's database. At 12:45 in the afternoon of December 9, 1977, officers Venegas and Sotelo of the El Paso Police Department were cruising in their patrol car. They observed the appellant, Brown, and another man walking in opposite directions away from one another in an alley. And although the two men were a few feet apart when they were first seen, Officer Venegas later testified that both officers believed the two had been together or were about to meet until the patrol car appeared. The car entered the alley and Officer Venegas got out and asked the appellant to identify himself and explain what he was doing there. The other man was not questioned or detained. The officer testified that he stopped the appellant because the situation looked suspicious and he had never seen that subject in the area before. That area of El Paso where the appellant was stopped has a high incidence of drug traffic. However, the officers did not claim to suspect the appellant of any specific misconduct, nor did they have any reason to believe that he was armed. The appellant refused to identify himself and angrily asserted that the officers had no right to stop him. Officer Venegas replied that he was in a high drug problem area, and Officer Sotelo then frisked the appellant but found nothing. When the appellant continued to refuse to identify himself, he was arrested for violation of the Texas Penal Code, which makes it a criminal act for a person to refuse to give his name and address to an officer who has lawfully stopped him and requested the information. Following the arrest, the officer searched the appellant. Nothing untoward was found. No drugs, no money, no guns. Now, while being taken to the El Paso County Jail, the appellant identified himself. Nonetheless, he was held in custody and charged with violating 3802A, and when he was booked, he was routinely searched a third time. The appellant was convicted in the El Paso Municipal Court and fined $20 plus court costs. He then exercised his right under Texas law to a trial de novo in the El Paso County Court. There, he moved to set aside the information on the grounds that 3802 of the Texas Penal Code violated the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments and was unconstitutionally vague and ambiguous in violation of the 14th Amendment. The motion was denied. The appellant waived jury trial, and the court convicted him and imposed a fine of $45 plus court costs. Now, I'm going to stop here. I would say this guy was a trained pro se litigant. He knew enough to waive jury trial because what he was arguing here was an issue of law. He knew that under Texas law that if the fine was under $100, he couldn't appeal to the Texas Supreme Court. And once he moved from the municipal court by de novo to the district court, he could go directly from the district court to the U.S. Supreme Court because he had exhausted all of his remedies in Texas. So either this case is being directed by the NAACP, if in fact this guy's black, or he's being helped by the ACLU or some other organization, could be the Gordon Law School or somebody else. But somebody somewhere, I think, had trained this fellow, because this is a pro se going straight to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, that sends a signal to me that says this guy's got to know something. He's not shooting from the hip. Now, a central concern in balancing these competing considerations in a variety of settings has been to assure that an individual's reasonable expectation of privacy, now that's a buzzword, reasonable expectation of privacy, a Fourth Amendment buzzword, is in place here, and is not subject to arbitrary invasion solely at the unfettered discretion of officers in the field. Now, to this end, the Fourth Amendment requires that a seizure must be based on specific objective facts indicating that society's legitimate interests require the seizure of the particular individual, or that the seizure must be carried out pursuant to a plan embodying explicit neutral limitations on the conduct of individual officers. And that's cited again from Delaware versus Prowse. Now, one of the things you'll notice here is that these courts, such as the Supreme Court, refer constantly to these base cases, Delaware versus Prowse, Miranda versus Arizona, Brown versus Texas, Lawson versus Colander, and they don't do that for no good reason. All of these cases taken together tell us the answer to the riddle. What should our conduct be like when we're out on the street in a confrontation with the police? How should you handle yourself? So if you'd like to drop $5 into the mail, send it to the law school, and we'll send you the 12 questions that you need to put in your jockey box or carry on your person, so that in the event you have one of these confrontations, you'll know how to handle it. Hey, I'm just about out of time. You've been listening to the Law Hour, and the editorial review are sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio and worldwide on the Internet. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. So if you want a list of all of the programs, just go to the archives, georgegordon.org. Go to the archives, and you can get, for instance, this set of programs. All right, we're out of time, and that's the signal. Our time is up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, goodbye, friends.